Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Gilbertson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may be coming forward.
Good morning. The first case for oral argument this morning is Kyle Burley, appellant, versus Kitech Innovative Sports Equipment, Inc., Appalee. For the appellant, we have Michael Tobin, attorney from Sioux Falls. For the appellee, we have Mark Arndt, an attorney from Sioux Falls. Mr. Tobin, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. Good morning. I represent Kylie Burley, the plaintiff and appellant in this matter, who, through no fault of her own, suffered a significant personal injury during her use of a product that was manufactured and sold by the defendant, Kitech, in this action. She was injured when a ring came free from the device during her use of it, recoiled with such velocity that when the ring struck my client in the left forearm, it shattered her ulna in approximately 13 different pieces, requiring surgery, the installation of a permanent metal plate, and approximately 7 screws. She is before this court this morning seeking the reversal of 2 decisions of the trial court. The first is the decision by the trial court to exclude her expert witness, Dr. Jan Burkout from the University of South Dakota, and his proffered testimony that the instructions that accompanied the product were seriously deficient, and additional opinions about the lack and complete absence of any warnings whatsoever. The second decision we are here before this court this morning concerns the grant of summary judgment, which was solely based on the trial court's determination that Ms. Burley was required to have expert testimony as to all claims in this product's liability action. Ms. Burley respectfully requests that this court reverse both those decisions. It is my intention this morning in this argument to discuss both issues, and I will begin with the exclusion of our expert testimony. It's long been settled under the United States Supreme Court decision in Daubert and its progeny, and this incorporation of it in State v. Hofer, that expert testimony should be admitted if it is both, number one, relevant, and number two, reliable. In this case, the trial court specifically found that Dr. Burkout's proposed expert testimony was relevant. The sole issue, therefore, at both the trial court level and here on appeal, is whether the proffered expert testimony is reliable. This court's standard of review in reviewing that decision is one for abuse of discretion. And we respectfully submit to this court that the trial court did, in fact, abuse its discretion in 3 different manners that we'd like to discuss this morning. The first is our contention that the circuit court ignored important probative evidence as to Dr. Burkout's qualifications. First, it's undisputed that Dr. Burkout at the University of South Dakota teaches graduate-level and doctoral-level courses that have emphasis and focus in both warnings and instructions. In the circuit court's decision, the circuit court noted that Dr. Burkout taught those courses, but when you fast-forward a few pages in the decision, when the circuit court provides its analysis in support of its decision to exclude the testimony, noticeably and conspicuously absent is any discussion of the graduate and doctoral level classes that Dr. Burkout teaches. A second subject of testimony or of evidence that we believe the trial court abused its discretion in failing to consider are the 4 PhD dissertations that Dr. Burkout, personally oversaw at the University of South Dakota. One of them had to do with instruction manuals for the operation of heavy equipment for the Wyoming Department of Transportation. The second one had to do with instruction sets for the operation of equipment on a Navy submarine. A third one had to do with product labels and instructions on food items. And the fourth, by far the most important one, is the one, I believe it's currently still going on, that has to do with tree stand assembly. Dr. Burkhout is supervising a PhD dissertation where a graduate student gets tree stands from manufacturers, takes the instructions. They give those instructions to volunteers who come to the Human Factors Lab in Vermilion. They're videotaped and recorded while they are trying to assemble the tree stands. Professor Burkhout and the graduate student then modify those instructions to some extent and give these new modified instructions to a second group. And that is done then for a third group. The only change in the whole entire experiment are wording of the instructions. And the focus is to make the tree stand assembly more efficient and better done. And I would submit to this court that the current ongoing dissertation with the tree stand assembly is incredibly important and relevant to this case in establishing Dr. Burkhout's qualifications, that his opinions are in fact reliable.
Did Dr. Burkhout have any experience in instructions for sports equipment?
I don't believe there's any evidence in the record that Dr. Burkhout has specifically dealt with instructions for products in sports equipment.
Was that one of the points that the court focused on?
It was, and it would be one that I would respectfully submit where the circuit court drew the Daubert analysis far too narrowly. There's nothing that I read in Daubert or this court's incorporation of it that requires such exactness amongst the contours of the expert's expertise and the field in which he or she intends to give proffered expert testimony. I posit this as a hypothetical as to that issue. It's entirely possible that whatever man or woman is in charge of the ANSI group for warnings and instructions, it's entirely possible that he or she has never been involved with athletic equipment and never written instructions or warnings for athletic equipment.
You know, it sounds to me a little bit like you're trying to re-argue the case de novo. We have a very deferential standard of review here, abuse of discretion. It could be if the trial court let it in, it would have been affirmed. But it could be also under that abuse of discretion standard if he kept it out, the trial court would be affirmed. How does this go so far that it constitutes an abuse of discretion instead of merely retrying the facts?
Well, I think the best evidence of the abuse of discretion is that the trial court failed to account for the evidence we put forward to establish Dr. Burkhout's qualifications. I think that it is a major shortcoming of the circuit court's analysis not to address these courses that Dr. Burkhout teaches. As we make this point several times in our briefs to this court, seemingly the circuit court made a decision that the standard for giving expert testimony in the courts of South Dakota is higher than the standards by which the University of South Dakota allows its professors to teach doctoral and graduate level courses. To me, I think that's completely backwards. I think that's part of the abuse of discretion, the ignoring of the evidence and then setting the standard so incredibly high. A second example, which we believe is an abuse of discretion, is the notation in the opinion, and it's not made in mere passing. It's prominently placed that one of the reasons the circuit court found Dr. Burkhout was not qualified is for the simplistic reason that he's never been asked to offer opinions on this issue before. And I say that simplistic because obviously every expert witness has to have a first time on an issue or in an area. There are obviously countless doctors who will graduate from the University of South Dakota Medical School who could very well be offered to give expert testimony in personal injury cases, work comp cases, etc., who have not done so yet. So the reliance on that factor, again, I think that's an abuse of discretion. There's no citation to any authority by either the circuit court or CHITEC in this appeal for the proposition that somehow is of some importance. I think the reliance on that issue further demonstrates the abuse of discretion. It's also important when discussing the qualifications for Dr. Burkhout to make mention that the defendant offered no contrary evidence whatsoever. The only evidence as to Dr. Burkhout's qualifications came from Dr. Burkhout in his two reports, in his affidavit, and in his deposition testimony. And that's important because the United States Supreme Court in Daubert made clear that Daubert-type analyses are not a substitute for the adversary process. In fact, the Supreme Court in Daubert said that the primary and best way to refute what somebody believes to be shaky expert testimony is the presentation of contrary evidence. That's noticeably lacking in this case. And I think
the court still has to be a gatekeeper. The contrary evidence, as I understand it, the court was talking about having the jury, once the experts go before the jury, then the jury decides between two conflicting opinions, which is correct. But the court also emphasized that the trial court has to be a gatekeeper. And isn't this the gatekeeping function we're talking about here today as opposed to the weighing function that the jury does?
Well, I certainly agree with you, Your Honor, that the trial court under Daubert is to perform that gatekeeping function. And oftentimes that gatekeeping function, I don't know if that expression is actually used in the Daubert opinion or not, but it certainly is by lawyers, judges, and legal commenters when discussing the case. But there's also another expression that comes right behind it, and that is keeping junk science out of courtrooms. Again, I don't think that term is in the opinion either, but they go hand in hand. Judges should act as gatekeepers to keep junk science out of courtrooms. And I think that stands in stark contrast to this case. There's no junk science involved here. Dr. Burkhout is a certified ergonomist. He's the director of the Human Factors Laboratory. We've already discussed the courses that he teaches and the dissertations that he has overseen. He's qualified to offer opinions because this is what he does for a living. So there's no junk science. So that's why in our brief, I referenced that instead of acting as a gatekeeper to keep junk science out, the trial court acted as a goalkeeper, blocking relevant, reliable testimony from being admitted so the jury can have that opportunity. So the jury can decide, we want to trust and rely upon this expert testimony or not.
Actually, his qualifications somewhat greatly exceed the qualifications of the manufacturer of this product who simply plagiarized it and copied it from somebody else.
That's correct, Your Honor, and I think that's an important point and one that's made in our brief. And I make that point that the manufacturer of this product has no education training whatsoever. She merely copies products that are sent to her. They do absolutely no testing of any kind. She knows nothing about these products. She testified that she doesn't even know the name of the company of the product that she ripped off that's at issue in this case. And I think that is important as a juxtaposition that the trial court says that Dr. Burkhout, with his qualifications, cannot come into the court and opine as to the adequacy of the instructions and warnings, yet seemingly this company in Minnesota is free to sell and market this product to the citizens of South Dakota when they truly, and I mean truly, know absolutely nothing about it.
Well, I don't see how you relate the two. The question isn't whether the manufacturer is being irresponsible or unknowing or is an uneducated person. The question is whether Burkhout meets the standard. So it doesn't seem to me that no matter what the plaintiff did, that has any relevance to Burkhout's qualifications.
I would agree to an extent that the lack of qualifications and the lack of any expertise and knowledge by the manufacturer does not directly relate to the issue of Dr. Burkhout and his qualifications. I would certainly agree with you as to that point. But I think it sets up a nice juxtaposition as if we look at this case as it currently exists, there's only one person and one person only who has any education, experience, training, and skill in dealing with instructions and warnings. That's Dr. Burkhout. The manufacturer itself doesn't even meet that standard. And of course, the other side has not proffered any contrary expert testimony either.
You mentioned the ANSI standards, and as I recall, the court said that Dr. Burkhout wasn't familiar with the ANSI standards. What is the significance of that?
It's true that's how Dr. Burkhout testified, and I don't think it's too significant at all. I think the case law is clear that merely because somebody meets an ANSI-type standard or a governmental or trade standard doesn't mean that the product still can't be attacked on negligence or products liability grounds. So I think the converse is also true. merely because somebody is not familiar with a trade or governmental standard should not, ipso facto, render a proffered expert as unreliable.
Were those standards relevant in this case?
That's a very good question. The issue of ANSI came out in Dr. Burkow's deposition, and the defense never came forward and said what, if any, ANSI standards would apply. We simply don't know. And that goes back to the lack of any evidence put forward by the defendant. We don't know if any ANSI standards would have any bearing on this whatsoever. We simply do not. I'd like to briefly turn to the summary judgment. It's clear that the heart of the summary judgment decision was the trial court's decision that expert testimony was a prerequisite for my client in proceeding with this product's liability claim. We believe that decision is erroneous and should be reversed because it contorts and distorts the law and, again, ignores important facts. As to the law, on page in the appendix of the opinion, it's A8, the trial court states that the cases are rare. That's the trial court's word. The cases are rare that require expert testimony to proceed. The next page, page 9 in the appendix, the trial court then states it's a general rule that the plaintiff must have expert testimony to proceed. I think that's an important internal inconsistency that goes directly to the issue, because certainly the trial court believed and found that expert testimony was required, but I do not see how those two statements can be reconciled, that the cases are rare when it's required. However, the next page is now a general rule that it is required. I think that's an important flaw. And guiding that flaw is, again, ignoring the facts. We've just somewhat discussed the defendant's testimony. Noticeably missing from the summary judgment analysis is any discussion whatsoever of the defendant's own testimony about no testing, no testing of component parts. But most important, and I think this is crucially important in this case, is the defendant's own testimony that she knew that if that hook were manipulated, that her product would be dangerous. That's her testimony. It's in the record at 231 on page 54 of her deposition.
That would go just to your theory of failure to warn, right? That wouldn't necessarily apply to all your theories.
Well, I think it does go to all of them because armed with that knowledge, she does nothing. She doesn't use a stronger metal hook that can't be bent. And I think the failure to use the stronger metal hook makes the product dangerous and defective, especially given her foreknowledge. And certainly it ties in with the failure to warn because armed with that foreknowledge, she also does not warn against anything. There's no warning anywhere in the instructions or on the product about prohibiting the manipulation of that hook or talking about the incredible forces that can be built up on this product. The trial court seemingly decided that this case is one that is so technical that it's beyond the ordinary comprehension of ordinary laymen and women to resolve. And it was that, I would submit, that drove the circuit court's decision that expert testimony was required. And I respectfully disagree. I don't think there's anything too difficult or technical about a weak or strong metal hook. I don't think there's anything too technical about a warning saying, don't bend this hook. And those are the issues we're dealing with. This is not the case. We can make many analogies to the medical realm where things can easily get beyond the ordinary comprehension of lay people who serve on juries. This is not one of them.
But the question here wasn't simply that the bent hook caused the injury. In this case, we have people that were bending the hook to try to make the product safer. And so we've got a fact question whether what they did exacerbated the likelihood of an injury or whether, you know, it's not just a simple case because you've got this intervening party that manipulated the product. And somebody's got to tell a jury which one was the cause here.
Well, I think that the defense is well equipped to do that. If they believed that testimony was needed in that regard, they were free to retain their own expert to come in and say that this product, as it left the manufacturer's hands, was completely safe, and it was solely the manipulation of the hook that caused these problems. From our standpoint, certainly the school district manipulated the hook, and they're involved in this lawsuit. They've certainly settled with us. So they're involved, and that testimony will certainly be heard by the jury. But again, it goes back to Dr. Burkhout's testimony and his opinions that it was foreseeable that the coach would make that manipulation, given his struggles with performing that downward chop. That downward chop is an authorized safety mechanism in the instructions. When the coaches tried it, they couldn't perform it, given some of the rotational issues with the belt and the hook. It was therefore foreseeable, given those problems, that somebody could bend that hook. And I think we can explain that to a jury, and it does not necessarily make this case so difficult or technical.
Thank you, Counselor.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Arndt, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel, I'm Mark Arndt on behalf of the defendants in Appalee, Kitech Innovative Sports Equipment. I want to start by reminding the court of a couple of undisputed facts in this case. Number one, the plaintiff in this case never read the instructions to the overspeed trainer. That fact is undisputed. She acknowledged that at her deposition. Secondly, it's undisputed, I think, as the court has recognized based on its questions, that Coach Horacek, the track coach and the agent for the school district, modified the device at issue before using it with his track athletes. It's somewhat difficult, perhaps, for counsel and I to stand up here and articulate that verbally. Certainly, photographs could be helpful, and I would note for the court's reference that, in particular, Deposition Exhibit Number 3 to Ms. Burley's deposition, which was part of the circuit court's opinion and was attached as Exhibit C to Kitech's statement of material facts, gives particular indication or a visual as to how those hooks look. Exhibit 3 depicts the one hook which was bent and the hook that was not bent, and is certainly helpful in the court looking at what Coach Horacek did to manipulate the device before it was used. The motion by Kitech was brought in two parts, as the court is well aware, and I will also begin with the Daubert portion of the motion. As the court has recognized, the standard of review for this court on a trial court's Daubert ruling is abuse of discretion. Other courts, I would note, have also concluded that at the trial level, it is actually the proponent of the expert testimony who bears the burden of proof to establish that their expert's testimony is both reliable and relevant. Again, the proponent of the expert, whether it be plaintiff or defendant, maintains that burden of proof. This court recognized that proposition in State v. Guthrie in 2001. I think what the Guthrie opinion does not establish, and if this court would like to take this opportunity, may want to clarify, is what the standard of that burden of proof is for the proponent. I would suggest to the court that most other jurisdictions have established that the proponent bears the burden of proof to a preponderance of the evidence for the reliability and relevance. Moving on with the Daubert analysis, we would note for the court that, again, undisputed, that Dr. Burkhout's lone opinion in this case, or an opinion that he wished to render, was that the instructions to the device were deficient. Kitech brought the Daubert motion largely because it is our opinion, and the trial court agreed, that Dr. Burkhout was simply not qualified to render that opinion as it related specifically to product instructions. The key statute, 1915-2, encompasses the U.S. Supreme Court's holding in Daubert and this court's 1994 holding in Hofer, and it provides that the witness is qualified if he has knowledge, skill, training, education, or experience in that particular field or that particular area. The trial court in this case specifically found that Dr. Burkhout did not meet any of those five qualifications to render opinions regarding instructions for a product or product liability. The knowledge, skill, training, education, or experience simply wasn't present with Dr. Burkhout in rendering that type of opinion in this case. Specifically, the trial court went on to note some of the factors in its opinion, And I would suggest to this court that the trial court wrote a detailed opinion and noted in there that it was undisputed, as Dr. Burkout testified, that he had no education and no training specifically related to product instructions. He's never published anything related to product instructions. He's never personally drafted any product instructions, let alone a product instruction similar to the device at issue in this case. He's never previously rendered or been asked to render opinions regarding product instructions, and he's not familiar with the American National Standards Institute, or ANISI, that I would suggest to the court is the industry standard for guidelines for product warnings.
Well, let me ask you, though, are those warnings relevant in this case?
Well, I think, Your Honor, the question that was posed to Dr. Burkout during his deposition regarding his familiarity with ANISI was more of an exploration of his general product instruction type background or knowledge. But I can't, to answer the court's question directly, I can't point to an ANISI standard that would apply to this particular device. I don't think anyone, quite frankly, has looked at it in this case. My question to Dr. Burkout was simply to explore his qualifications as a product instruction expert.
But the court did use that as a reason for saying he was not qualified, he was not familiar with those standards.
I think that's correct, and I think the court specifically noted the Robertson v. Norton Company opinion, the 1998 Eighth Circuit opinion, in that regard, because the Eighth Circuit also noted in disqualifying an expert witness or upholding the trial court's disqualification that particular witness was not familiar with the ANSI standards.
But in that case, were the ANSI standards relevant?
They may have been, Your Honor. They certainly may have been.
I mean, here we're just talking about a general knowledge, which may or may not be relevant.
Yeah.
Doesn't that suggest to you that it's possibly, that at least that part of the court's opinion is arbitrary when it says, even though it may or may not be relevant, I'm still saying that he's not qualified because he's not familiar with irrelevant standards?
And I would respectfully disagree with the court, again, in the larger context of this particular witness's knowledge as it relates to product instructions in general. I believe ANISI is the industry standard, and for a person to claim himself or hold himself out as an expert witness as it relates to product instructions or warnings and not be familiar at all with the American National Standards Institute, I think is surprising and, again, goes to his credibility or expertise regarding product instructions.
What about the comment that your opponent makes that when the court says he's never testified on this subject before, that disqualifies him? Does that suggest that the court's being arbitrary?
I think it's one factor that the trial court used in this case, Your Honor. It certainly is not dispositive of the issue. Counsel's point is well taken that everyone has to have a first time. But that was simply one factor that the trial court used in this case in deciding that Dr. Burkout was not qualified for product instructions.
What troubles or concerns me a little bit is I doubt you would find anybody in South Dakota with even this level of expertise, yet the trial court found here that it was insufficient to be able to testify as an expert witness for this plaintiff. Are we setting the bar so high in this state as far as the doorkeeping function that we are literally slamming the doors in the face of any injured parties seeking relief in South Dakota courts, the only option being that if they got a big enough war chest to go out and hire an expert in Maryland or Colorado or someplace like that.
I can acknowledge the court's position on that, and to give you a frank answer, I don't know where the appropriate expert would come from in this particular case. I have to think there are other manufacturers of sports equipment in the state of South Dakota that may also draft product instructions that accompany their particular devices. But quite frankly, I don't know that. But I think the more relevant question for this court is whether or not the trial court abused its discretion in allowing or disallowing this particular expert to give his expert testimony to the jury. We're all familiar with the gatekeeping function of the trial court via the D'Albert opinion, and I think the underlying policy surrounding that is the importance of jurors or the weight that jurors rely upon expert testimony. When an expert gets up on that witness stand and suggests to the jury that it's X because of Y, we all know that the jurors are going to place high opinions or high weight upon those experts.
Well, isn't that the whole point? Isn't that the whole point of a jury trial? is to have the jury decide between a battle of the experts or between one expert and one manufacturer. Just as Zinner says, someone has to tell the jury which one's at fault, the manufacturer or the manipulator. Isn't that the jury question to determine based on the evidence, or should the evidence be all kept out so that the result is predetermined?
No, I don't believe the evidence should be kept out altogether, but certainly the expert needs to be qualified before he can render that opinion. And I think that is the point, Your Honor. That is the gatekeeping function that the trial court's required to go through Daubert. And again,
but still, when you have the expert testify, aren't we taking this almost, and I guess I follow up on Justice Gilbertson's question, is that aren't we almost taking this away from the jury if we rule, if we say that this standard is so high that they, you know, following what the trial court did in this case, he's never testified before, he doesn't have any expertise in the sports instructions. I mean, he's testifying about the instructions themselves. I question whether that's almost common sense for the jury to look at those instructions and see if they can follow them or not. So, you know, he's saying you need an expert, but he set the standard so high that no one in South Dakota probably could meet that expertise. And then he throws out the case because the expert, he's thrown out the expert. This seems to go against the flexibility of that original Daubert gatekeeping function. I mean, it's still got to be flexible, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I believe it does need to be flexible, Your Honor. And I would suggest to you that the trial court's decision to disallow Dr. Burkhout in this case was not so rigid that it turns that process on its head. Keep in mind that it is undisputed in this case, via Dr. Burkhout's own testimony, after we received his curriculum vitae, 39 pages in length, that mentions almost nothing about product instructions, and after we received his written opinions, we deposed him to explore his qualifications. And the questions that were put to him, I'll note for the court on page 10 of Appley's brief, are very straightforward and very simple, and I want to remind the court of the questions and answer. Question by counsel, do you have any specific education or training related to product instructions? Not sports equipment, but product instructions. And the simple answer is no. The next question, can I also assume that you haven't published anything on product instructions or product warnings? And again, the answer is no, I haven't. And if you follow that up with the cases that we've cited for the court, many of which are Eighth Circuit decisions, the courts are critical of experts who have never drafted product instructions themselves, who have never tested product instruction theories that they believe are incorrect. The courts are critical of people simply looking at the instructions in hindsight and coming up with an opinion with no background or not drafting instructions on their own and no education or training specifically related to those products. The courts simply aren't allowing those experts to testify at the trial court level, again, because we know the weight that the jurors will place on that expert testimony.
But how can we?
Why do you even need them?
Go ahead.
How can we say a person who's got a PhD, teaches at the University of South Dakota, and has a 39-page vita is advocating junk science?
Well, because it has to be related to the facts of this specific case, Your Honor. It has to be related to product instructions. The curriculum vitae can be as long as it wants, but if he's not qualified in the area of product instructions, as again, many of the opinions have noted, which specifically relate to display, syntax, emphasis when it comes to product warnings, if he's not qualified or educated to render opinions on those topics, then he should not be allowed to testify. And that's the specifics of this case. And I would get back to Justice Meyer-Henry's question regarding throwing the entire case out because the expert is unqualified. Keep in mind that the only opinion Dr. Burkhout was attempting to opine in this case was related to product instructions. He wasn't rendering opinions regarding negligent design, manufacturer, or failure to warn. He was only attempting to opine regarding the product's instructions. Plaintiff put forth no expertise regarding those other causes of action. And we obviously can work our way into that summary judgment part of the court's analysis.
But so the practical effect of the case, if it goes your way, is that an outside manufacturer can copy or plagiarize, copy a product and plagiarize instructions without any expertise itself, manufacture it, send it into the state of South Dakota, and it's free to do whatever harm can be done because there's not an expert here available to counter them. So you either have to go outside the state to come up with an expert. And in effect, this is a matter of common sense. Wouldn't it be common sense for the manufacturer to just say, don't modify the hook, or don't do anything with the hook? I mean, isn't that a matter of common sense?
It may be common sense in hindsight, but it may also be common sense in hindsight for the weed eater manufacturer to say, don't trim your child's hair with our device. I mean, we can look at these things from a common sense perspective, Your Honor, and in hindsight, the common sense becomes
right.
much more
if
clear.
If it's common sense in hindsight, then why is an expert even necessary?
Well, an expert's necessary as it relates to product instructions because the jury's going to place particular weight on that expert's testimony. And if it's not necessary, then there's really no reason for plaintiff to
That doesn't create any unfair advantage. The defense is probably in a far better position to find outside experts to counter that expert.
Well,
so I think we've got a totally uneven playing field under your scenario.
I'm not so sure I'd agree with the court, and I would also, I guess, note for all the members of the court that I'm not so sure we can concede that you can't find a local expert to testify regarding some of these issues. Dr. Burkout is simply not the qualified expert to testify regarding this. Perhaps there are other product instruction experts in the state of South Dakota. I don't know. I've never looked. But, of course, that's not the defendant's burden in this case. That's the plaintiff's burden. And I would, I guess, suggest to the court that it is not necessarily it's too much to jump to a conclusion that it's an unfair advantage for the defendant in this case. And I do want to touch on the summary judgment portion of the court's ruling, and I think that Taylor's a little bit into the topic Justice Sabers was raising, and that is whether or not an expert testimony is needed. And obviously the trial court in this case concluded that it was.
Before you get into that any farther, please respond to Mr. Tobin's point that the manufacturer herself admitted the product was dangerous.
Well,
in her deposition.
I would have to refer back to the deposition transcript, which is part of the record, but what I would say to the court is I think the manufacturer's only acknowledgement was that if you modify our device, if you take the pliers and bend the hook, there is a chance that this swivel ring could come off inadvertently, which appears to be the case here. So I think that's the acknowledgement on behalf of the manufacturer.
Isn't that enough to save summary judgment?
No, I don't believe it is, Your Honor, because I think, again, getting into the summary judgment issues, in order for the jurors to understand what the reasonable manufacturer would do, they need some baseline. We need to establish a baseline in order for that to happen. Expert testimony is needed when a topic is beyond the common sense or the ken knowledge is the key phrase of the average juror. The average juror obviously isn't a manufacturer of sporting equipment. The average manufacturer can't tell what is appropriate and what is not appropriate when manufacturing sports equipment. Plaintiff's counsel notes that it should be as simple as using a stronger metal for this hook to avoid somebody taking a pliers and being able to bend it. But, of course, what we don't know is a stronger metal available? If so, is it cost feasible to use? If so, would the stronger metal be so heavy that it renders the device otherwise ineffective?
Shouldn't those all be defense standards? Shouldn't those all be burdens on the defense to offset that?
If the plaintiff can prove that by establishing a baseline of knowledge for what a reasonable manufacturer should do. But I don't believe it's the average juror's knowledge to know those things and be able to decide that issue.
But if common sense tells us that the hook should be stronger or You can't modify the hook because it'd be a dangerous situation. First of all, why do we need an expert, or why shouldn't the defense have the burden then of coming in and showing that you can't modify the hook, there's no stronger metal to work with?
Well, if the plaintiff has met their burden in putting forth that expert testimony by being able to establish the appropriate baseline, then yes, the defense can come in and offer counter testimony to that. But again, I think the general rule for product liability cases is that expert testimony is generally required because it's beyond the lay knowledge of the jurors. There's a lot of questions regarding whether or not a stronger metal could be used, or would it be cost effective, or would it be strong enough even if it was out there. But without expert testimony from an engineer or other, it would be impossible to establish those things. That's plaintiff's burden in order to meet their elements of their causes of action as they pled. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Arndt. Mr. Tobin, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Tobin, before I forget it, what evidence was in the record suggesting that the defect was the proximate cause of the injury in this case? The manufacturing defect or the warning defect?
Well, I think it comes from both the track coach, Coach Horacek, and the defendant itself, Jody Michelson, the owner. I think the testimony of her foreknowledge is very important as to both the warning and the defect issue. If they know they've got that problem and do nothing about it, I mean, I think that's just simply unconscionable. This is a drastic parallel, but it's somewhat akin to the Ford Pinto situation.
But I guess let me be more specific. With the modification, considering that, what evidence is there that the defect as it left the factory was the proximate cause?
If I'm understanding correctly, it's our contention that the defect is the knowledge that this metal hook can be bent, and if bent, renders the product unsafe. To me, that's the defect. Not to use a stronger piece of metal. And I respectfully disagree. I don't think it's going to cost an arm and a leg more or render this product unusable by simply using a stronger piece of metal or warning against it. And I think that's even an easier, more cost-efficient way to address this known harm. But it's that knowledge that they have of what could result and then them doing nothing about it. I think that's the defect. The defect would be the hook that's not strong enough. The facts of this case bear that out. Think of the forces that were built up on that line. I mean, incredible amount of tension and force. Of course, the defendant has no idea how much force could be built up or how much this metal hook could withstand. But Dr. Burkhout even discusses in his second report that this hook, with these forces that could be built up, could be gradually and slowly opened over time.
But that's not what happened here. We have a manipulation of the hook by someone other than the manufacturer.
That's true, and that really goes to the causes of action that we have pled. One is negligence, and if that's the one that we want to go with the jury with, then I think the jury can make a decision as to between the manufacturer and the school district, who's more at fault, and can proportion it out accordingly. If we go with the strict liability claims, then I think the school district, you don't get into proportionality any longer, but the misuse is an absolute defense. So that raises some good lawyering questions that we would have to face. But I think that merely because it was modified, I don't think that keeps us out of court, especially given Dr. Burkhout and his opinions that it was reasonably foreseeable for somebody to modify that hook, given the instructions that the downward chop is a safety mechanism and they couldn't make it work. And that's really the start of what happened to my client. The coaches, I think, did the right thing. On the first day they used this, they tried to figure it out themselves before they gave it to a bunch of teenagers. They couldn't make sense of the instructions. They couldn't make sense of the instructions, even though an assistant coach had recently used it at the University of South Dakota. They did know, however, that this downward chop is an authorized means of disengaging that thwart. They tried it. Couldn't make it work. So given that instruction, I think it is reasonably foreseeable that somebody could open that hook up a little bit to make that safety mechanism functional. And that's what started this. And I think that's reasonably foreseeable. That comes from Dr. Burkhout, but I also think it's reasonably foreseeable even in the absence of his expert opinion. I'd like to quickly address, the defense started out its argument by stating that my client never read the instructions. I would suggest that's a complete red herring. She was a minor. She was a junior in high school. The defendant readily conceded in her deposition that she knew that the people who ordered and paid for the product would not be the same people who used the product. I think given that testimony and the testimony that she knew that minors would be using it, I just don't think that it somehow renders our case less strong because she herself never read the instructions. And that makes sense from an everyday standpoint. The school district gets it. Hopefully they know how to use it, and then they give it to their students. But more importantly, it goes to relevance. It has nothing to do with reliability. And the trial court specifically found that Dr. Burkhout's opinions were, in fact, relevant. So I would suggest that is a red herring.
Just as an aside, and I don't know how crucial this is or even if it's important, but was the instructions included the downward chop?
Correct.
And did the downward chop, was it supposed to be exerted on the hook side, or was it supposed to be exerted on the ring side that went through the hook, that the hook went into, I mean?
It's exerted on the line that's connected to the ring that is on the hook. So if I'm being the person being pulled, there's this cord that comes right to my belly that's attached to the ring, and the ring is on the hook. And by doing the downward chop, it's a means of obviously making that line and ring go below the hook and safely release you.
So you're chopping on the ring to force it off of the hook.
Correct.
Okay,
correct.
Thank you.
In State v. Guthrie, this court stated that expert witness testimony need not be above all criticism before it's admissible. The defense certainly believes that it has criticisms of Dr. Burkhout's testimony. If relevant at trial, those criticisms could be used in cross-examination. But merely because it can be criticized does not mean it should be kept out of trial. The jury should hear these criticisms and make the determination. Because this is not junk science, the jury should decide what these criticisms are of such importance that they will not rely on it. Also in State v. Guthrie, this court stated that it interprets the rules of evidence liberally and with the goal to relax the traditional barriers to the admissibility of expert testimony. I think that statement's important. I think the court is correct that the trial court raised the bar for the admissibility of expert testimony, maybe impermissibly high. But this court's case law in State v. Guthrie states the opposite. It relaxes the traditional barriers to the admissibility of expert testimony and interprets the rules of evidence liberally for the admissibility of the expert testimony. I think the State v. Guthrie case stands in stark contrast to the approach and the analysis used by the trial court in this matter.
Let me ask you one more question about summary judgment. On all causes of action except the warning case, the warning theory, your opponent's brief suggests that Burkhout admitted that he was not rendering any opinion on design, manufacture, or defect in the product. How do you respond to that?
My response is that's accurate. Dr. Burkhout was not retained to opine on the defect design issues.
So should those causes of action, were they properly dismissed? Everything but warning?
I do not believe so. And again, it goes back to the defendant's own testimony. Under South Dakota law in the products liability realm, the law states that products must be tested. Component parts must be tested. Foreseeable harms must be warned against. Her own testimony establishes that they did none of that. So I don't know what more an expert witness could do to come in other than to parrot that testimony that, no, they should have tested it.
Well, but you still have to show causation. Isn't that traditionally, in products liability, isn't causation traditionally an expertise that the courts rely on?
It is, but I think the causation element comes from the track coach's own testimony. His testimony was that he opened it. He and two other coaches tried to read the instructions. They tried to figure it out. They could not do so, and as a result, he bent that hook. So I think he offers the causation between the indecipherable instructions and the problems associated with the weak hook. Through him, the causation comes to the injury to my client. If he could not understand those instructions, then it's, of course, reasonably foreseeable, and I think that it is, that somebody would bend that hook, given the instruction statement that the downward child is an accepted means of disengaging oneself from the device.
The coach is not an engineer, is he? He uses sports equipment. He doesn't design sports equipment. He doesn't manufacture it. Traditionally, don't these types of cases require expertise on the question of causation, which you don't appear to have here?
I could briefly respond.
Yes, yes.
Thank you. I would answer that question by citing the first part of the trial court's decision, where the trial court, citing applicable case law, stated that the case is rare where expert testimony is needed. And I think that applies with equal force to the product's liability realm. It's only when the issue is so technical and beyond the comprehension of ordinary men and women that the expert testimony is needed. I don't see any of those technical detailed issues in this case, and I think an ordinary jury could certainly understand, digest, and resolve this matter. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. Court will be in recess for 10 minutes.